Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Chapter 8. Conclusion. All the crimes and villainies that had been perpetrated were discovered with extraordinary rapidity, much more quickly than Pyotr Stepanovich had expected. To begin with, the luckless Marya Ignatyevna waked up before daybreak on the night of her husband's murder, missed him, and flew into indescribable agitation, not seeing him beside her. The woman who had been hired by Anna Prohorovna and was there for the night could not succeed in calming her, and, as soon as it was daylight, ran to fetch Arina Prohorovna herself, assuring the invalid that the latter knew where her husband was and when he would be back. Meantime, Arina Prohorovna was in some anxiety too. She had already heard from her husband of the deed perpetrated that night at Skvoreshniki. He had returned home about 11 o'clock in a terrible state of mind and body. Wringing his hands, he flung himself face downwards on his bed, and shaking with convulsive sobs, kept repeating, "It's not right! It's not right! It's not right at all!" He ended, of course, by confessing it all to Arina Prohorovna, but to no one else in the house. She left him on his bed, sternly impressing upon him that if he must blubber, he must do it in his pillow so as not to be overheard, and that he would be a fool if he showed any traces of it next day. She felt somewhat anxious, however, and began at once to clear things up in case of emergency. She succeeded in hiding or completely destroying all suspicious papers, books, manifestos, perhaps. At the same time, she reflected that she, her sister, her aunt, her sister-in-law, the student, and perhaps even her long-eared brother, had really nothing much to be afraid of. When the nurse ran to her in the morning, she went without a second thought to Marya Ignatyevna's. She was desperately anxious, moreover, to find out whether what her husband had told her that night in a terrified and frantic whisper that was almost like delirium was true, that is, whether Pyotr Stepanovich had been right in his reckoning that Kirillov would sacrifice himself for the general benefit. But she arrived at Marya Ignatyevna's too late. When the latter had sent off the woman and was left alone, she was unable to bear the suspense. She got out of bed, and throwing round her the first garment she could find, something very light and unsuitable for the weather, I believe, she ran down to Kirillov's lodge herself, thinking that he, perhaps, would be better able than anyone to tell her something about her husband. The terrible effect on her of what she saw there may well be imagined. It is remarkable that she did not read Kirillov's last letter, which lay conspicuously on the table, overlooking it, of course, in her fright. She ran back to her room, snatched up her baby, and went with it, out of the house, into the street. It was a damp morning. There was a fog. She met no passers-by in such an out-of-the-way street. She ran on, breathless, through the wet, cold mud, and at last began knocking at the doors of the houses. In the first house, no one came to the door. In the second, they were so long in coming that she gave it up impatiently and began knocking at a third door. This was the house of a merchant called Titov. Here she wailed and kept declaring incoherently that her husband was murdered, causing a great flutter in the house. Something was known about Shatov and his story in the Titov household. They were horror-stricken that she should be running about the streets in such attire and in such cold, with the baby scarcely covered in her arms, when, according to her story, she had only been confined the day before. They thought at first that she was delirious, especially as they could not make out whether it was Kirillov who was murdered or her husband. Seeing that they did not believe her, she would have run on farther, but they kept her by force, and, I am told, she screamed and struggled terribly. They went to Filipov's, and within 2 hours Kirillov's suicide and the letter he had left were known to the whole town. The police came to question Marya Ignatyevna, who was still conscious, and it appeared at once that she had not read Kirillov's letter, and they could not find out from her what had led her to conclude that her husband had been murdered. She only screamed that if Kirillov was murdered, then her husband was murdered, they were together. Towards midday, she sank into a state of unconsciousness from which she never recovered, and she died 3 days later. The baby had caught cold and died before her. Arina Prohorovna, not finding Marya Ignatyevna and the baby, and guessing something was wrong, was about to run home, but she checked herself at the gate, and sent the nurse to inquire of the gentleman at the lodge whether Marya Ignatyevna was not there, and whether he knew anything about her. The woman came back, screaming frantically. Persuading her not to scream and not to tell anyone by the time-honoured argument that she would get into trouble, she stole out of the yard. It goes without saying that she was questioned the same morning as having acted as midwife to Marya Ignatyevna, but they did not get much out of her. She gave a very cool and sensible account of all she had herself heard and seen at Shartov's, but as to what had happened, she declared that she knew nothing and could not understand it. It may well be imagined what an uproar there was in the town. A new sensation, another murder. But there was another element in this case. It was clear that a secret society of murderers, incendiaries, and revolutionists did exist, did actually exist. Liza's terrible death, the murder of Stavrogin's wife, Stavrogin himself, the fire, the ball for the benefit of the governesses, the laxity of manners and morals in Yulia Mikhailovna's circle. Even in the disappearance of Stepan Trofimovich, people insisted on scenting a mystery. All sorts of things were whispered about Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch. By the end of the day, people knew of Pyotr Stepanovich's absence too, and, strange to say, less was said of him than of anyone. What was talked of most all that day was the senator. There was a crowd almost all day at Filipov's house. The police certainly were led astray by Kirillov's letter. They believed that Kirillov had murdered Shartov and had himself committed suicide. Yet, though the authorities were thrown into perplexity, they were not altogether hoodwinked. The word park, for instance, so vaguely inserted in Kirillov's letter, did not puzzle anyone, as Pyotr Stepanovich had expected it would. The police at once made a rush for Skvoreshniki, not simply because it was the only park in the neighbourhood, but also led thither by a sort of instinct, because all the horrors of the last few days were connected, directly or indirectly, with Skvoreshniki. That, at least, is my theory. I may remark that Varvara Petrovna had driven off early that morning in chase of Stepan Trofimovich, and knew nothing of what had happened in the town. The body was found in the pond that evening. What led to the discovery of it was the finding of Shartov's cap at the scene of the murder, where it had been with extraordinary carelessness overlooked by the murderers. The appearance of the body, the medical examination and certain deductions from it, roused immediate suspicions that Kirillov must have had accomplices. It became evident that a secret society really did exist, of which Shartov and Kirillov were members, and which was connected with the manifestos. Who were these accomplices? No one even thought of any member of the quintet that day. It was ascertained that Kirillov had lived like a hermit, and in so complete a seclusion that it had been possible, as stated in the letter, for Fedka to lodge with him for many days, even while an active search was being made for him. The chief thing that worried everyone was the impossibility of discovering a connecting link in this chaos. There is no saying what conclusions and what disconnected theories our panic-stricken townspeople would have reached if the whole mystery had not been suddenly solved next day, thanks to Lyamshin. He broke down. He behaved as even Pyotr Stepanovich had towards the end begun to fear he would. Left in charge of Tolkachenka and afterwards of Erkel, he spent all the following day lying in his bed with his face turned to the wall, apparently calm, not uttering a word, and scarcely answering when he was spoken to. This is how it was that he heard nothing all day of what was happening in the town. But Tolkachenka, who was very well informed about everything, took into his head by the evening to throw up the task of watching Lyamshin, which Pyotr Stepanovich had laid upon him, and left the town. That is, to put it plainly, made his escape. The fact is, they lost their heads, as Erkel had predicted they would. I may mention, by the way, that Liputin had disappeared the same day before 12 o'clock, but things fell out so that his disappearance did not become known to the authorities till the evening of the following day, when the police went to question his family, who were panic-stricken at his absence, but kept quiet from fear of consequences. But to return to Liamshin, as soon as he was left alone, Erkel had gone home earlier, relying on Tolkachenko. He ran out of his house, and, of course, very soon learned the position of affairs. Without even returning home, he too tried to run away without knowing where he was going, but the night was so dark, and to escape was so terrible and difficult, that after going through 2 or 3 streets, he returned home and locked himself up for the whole night. I believe that towards morning he attempted to commit suicide, but did not succeed. He remained locked up till midday, and then suddenly he ran to the authorities. He is said to have crawled on his knees, to have sobbed and shrieked, to have kissed the floor, crying out that he was not worthy to kiss the boots of the officials standing before him. They soothed him, were positively affable to him. His examination lasted, I am told, for 3 hours. He confessed everything. Everything. Told every detail, everything he knew, every point, anticipating their questions, hurried to make a clean breast of it all, volunteering unnecessary information without being asked. It turned out that he knew enough and presented things in a fairly true light. The tragedy of Shatov and Kirillov, the fire, the death of the Lebyadkins, and the rest of it were relegated to the background. Pyotr Stepanovich, the secret society, the organization and the network were put in the first place. When asked what was the object of so many murders and scandals and dastardly outrages, he answered with feverish haste that it was with the idea of systematically undermining the foundations, systematically destroying society and all principles, with the idea of nonplussing everyone and making hay of everything. And then, when society was tottering, sick and out of joint, cynical and sceptical, though filled with an intense eagerness for self-preservation and for some guiding idea, suddenly to seize it in their hands, raising the standard of revolt and relying on a complete network of quintets, which were actively meanwhile gathering recruits and seeking out the weak spots which could be attacked. In conclusion, he said that here in our town, Pyotr Stepanovich had organized only the first experiment in such systematic disorder, so to speak, as a program for further activity and for all the quintets, and that this was his own, Liamshin's idea, his own theory, and that he hoped they would remember it and bear in mind how openly and properly he had given his information, and therefore might be of use hereafter. Being asked definitely how many quintets there were, he answered that there were immense numbers of them, that all Russia was overspread with a network, and although he brought forward no proofs, I believe his answer was perfectly sincere. He produced only the program of the society, printed abroad, and the plan for developing a system of future activity roughly sketched in Pyotr Stepanovich's own handwriting. It appeared that Liamshin had quoted the phrase about undermining the foundation word for word from this document, not omitting a single stop or comma, though he had declared that it was all his own theory. Of Yulia Mikhailovna, he very funnily and quite without provocation volunteered the remark that she was innocent and had been made a fool of. But strange to say, he exonerated Nikolai Stavrogin from all share in the secret society, from any collaboration with Pyotr Stepanovich. Liamshin had no conception of the secret and very absurd hopes that Pyotr Stepanovich was resting on Stavrogin. According to his story, Nikolai Stavrogin had nothing whatever to do with the death of the Lebyadkins, which had been planned by Pyotr Stepanovich alone, and with the subtle aim of implicating the former in the crime, and therefore making him dependent on Pyotr Stepanovich, but instead of the gratitude on which Pyotr Stepanovitch had reckoned with shallow confidence, he had roused nothing but indignation and even despair in the generous heart of Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch. He wound up by a hint, evidently intentional, volunteered hastily, that Stavrogin was perhaps a very important personage, but that there was some secret about that, that he had been living among us, so to say, incognito, that he had some commission, and that, very possibly, he would come back to us again from Petersburg. Lyamshin was convinced that Stavrogin had gone to Petersburg, but in quite a different capacity, and in different surroundings, in the suite of persons of whom, perhaps, we should soon hear, and that all this he had heard from Pyotr Stepanovitch, Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch's secret enemy. Here I will note that 2 months later, Lyamshin admitted that he had exonerated Stavrogin on purpose, hoping that he would protect him and would obtain for him a mitigation in the second degree of his sentence, and that he would provide him with money and letters of introduction in Siberia. From this confession, it is evident that he had an extraordinarily exaggerated conception of Stavrogin's powers. On the same day, of course, the police arrested Virginsky, and in their zeal took his whole family too. Arina Prohorovna, her sister, aunt, and even the girl student were released long ago. They say that Shigalyov, too, will be set free very shortly, because he cannot be classed with any of the other prisoners. But all that is so far only gossip. Virginsky at once pleaded guilty. He was lying ill with fever when he was arrested. I am told that he seemed almost relieved. It was a load off his heart, he is reported to have said. It is rumoured that he is giving evidence without reservation, but with a certain dignity, and has not given up any of his bright hopes, though at the same time he curses the political method, as opposed to the socialist one, in which he had been unwittingly and heedlessly carried by the vortex of combined circumstances. His conduct at the time of the murder has been put in a favourable light, and I imagine that he too may reckon on some mitigation of his sentence. That at least is what is asserted in the town. But I doubt whether there is any hope for mercy in Erkel's case. Ever since his arrest, he has been obstinately silent, or has misrepresented the facts as far as he could. Not one word of regret has been wrung from him so far. Yet even the sternest of the judges trying him has been moved to some compassion by his youth, by his helplessness, by the unmistakable evidence that he is nothing but a fanatical victim of a political impostor, and, most of all, by his conduct to his mother, to whom, as it appears, he used to send almost the half of his small salary. His mother is now in the town. She is a delicate and ailing woman, aged beyond her years. She weeps and positively grovels on the ground, imploring mercy for her son. Whatever may happen, many among us feel sorry for Erkel. Liputin was arrested in Petersburg, where he had been living for a fortnight. His conduct there sounds almost incredible and is difficult to explain. He is said to have had a passport in a forged name and quite a large sum of money upon him, and had every possibility of escaping abroad, yet instead of going, he remained in Petersburg. He spent some time hunting for Stavrogin and Pyotr Stepanovitch. Suddenly he took to drinking, and gave himself up to a debauchery that exceeded all bounds, like a man who had lost all reason and understanding of his position. He was arrested in Petersburg, drunk in a brothel. There is a rumour that he has not by any means lost heart, that he tells lies in his evidence, and is preparing for the approaching trial hopefully, and, as it were, triumphantly. He even intends to make a speech at the trial. Tolkachenko, who was arrested in the neighbourhood 10 days after his flight, behaves with incomparably more decorum. He does not shuffle or tell lies. He tells all he knows, does not justify himself, blames himself with all modesty, though he, too, has a weakness for rhetoric. He readily tells what he knows, and when knowledge of the peasantry and the revolutionary elements among them is touched upon, he positively attitudinizes and is eager to produce an effect. He, too, is meaning, I am told, to make a speech at the trial. Neither he nor Liputin seem very much afraid, curious as it seems. I repeat that the case is not yet over. Now, 3 months afterwards, local society has had time to rest, has recovered, has got over it, has an opinion of its own, so much so that some people positively look upon Pyotr Stepanovich as a genius, or at least as possessed of some characteristics of a genius. Organization, they say at the club, holding up a finger. But all this is very innocent, and there are not many people who talk like that. Others, on the other hand, do not deny his acuteness, but point out that he was utterly ignorant of real life, that he was terribly theoretical, grotesquely and stupidly one-sided, and consequently shallow in the extreme. As for his moral qualities, all are agreed. About that, there are no two opinions. I do not know whom to mention next, so as not to forget anyone. Mavriky Nikolaevich has gone away for good, I don't know where. Old Madame Drostov has sunk into dotage. I still have one very gloomy story to tell, however. I will confine myself to the bare facts. On her return from Ustyeva, Varvara Petrovna stayed at her townhouse. All the accumulated news broke upon her at once and gave her a terrible shock. She shut herself up alone. It was evening. Everyone was tired and went to bed early. In the morning, a maid with a mysterious air handed a note to Darya Pavlovna. The note had, so she said, arrived the evening before, but late, when all had gone to bed, so that she had not ventured to wake her. It had not come by post, but had been put in Alexei Yegorych's hand in Skvoreshniki by some unknown person, and Alexei Yegorych had immediately set off and put it into her hands himself, and had then returned to Skvoreshniki. For a long while, Darya Pavlovna gazed at the letter with a beating heart and dared not open it. She knew from whom it came. The writer was Nikolai Stavrogin. She read what was written on the envelope. To Alexei Yegorych, to be given secretly to Darya Pavlovna. Here is the letter, word for word, without the slightest correction of the defects in style of a Russian aristocrat who had never mastered the Russian grammar, in spite of his European education. Dear Darya Pavlovna, at one time you expressed a wish to be my nurse and made me promise to send for you when I wanted you. I am going away in 2 days and shall not come back. Will you go with me? Last year, like Herzen, I was naturalized as a citizen of the canton of Uri, and that nobody knows. There I've already bought a little house. I've still 12,000 rubles left. We'll go and live there forever. I don't want to go anywhere else, ever. It's a very dull place, a narrow valley. The mountains restrict both vision and thought. It's very gloomy. I chose the place because there was a little house to be sold. If you don't like it, I'll sell it and buy another in some other place. I am not well, but I hope to get rid of hallucinations in that air. It's physical, and as for the moral, you know everything. But do you know all? I've told you a great deal of my life, but not all, even to you, not all. By the way, I repeat that in my conscience I feel myself responsible for my wife's death. I haven't seen you since then, that's why I repeat it. I feel guilty about Lizaveta Nikolaevna, too, but you know about that. You foretold almost all that. Better not come to me. My asking you to is a horrible meanness, and why should you bury your life with me? You are dear to me, and when I was miserable, it was good to be beside you. Only with you I could speak of myself aloud, but that proves nothing. You defined it yourself. A nurse. It's your own expression. Why sacrifice so much? Grasp this, too, that I have no pity for you since I ask you, and no respect for you since I reckon on you. And yet, I ask you and I reckon on you. In any case, I need your answer, for I must set off very soon. In that case, I shall go alone. I expect nothing of Uri. I am simply going. I have not chosen a gloomy place on purpose. I have no ties in Russia. Everything is as alien to me there as everywhere. It's true that I dislike living there more than anywhere, but I can't hate anything even there. I've tried my strength everywhere. You advised me to do this that I might learn to know myself. As long as I was experimenting for myself and for others, it seemed infinite, as it has all my life. Before your eyes, I endured a blow from your brother. I acknowledged my marriage in public. But to what to apply my strength, that is what I've never seen, and do not see now, in spite of all your praises in Switzerland, which I believed in. I am still capable, as I always was, of desiring to do something good, and of feeling pleasure from it. At the same time, I desire evil, and feel pleasure from that, too. But both feelings are always too petty, and are never very strong. My desires are too weak, they are not enough to guide me. On a log one may cross a river, but not on a chip. I say this that you may not believe that I am going to Uri with hopes of any sort. As always, I blame no one. I've tried the depths of debauchery and wasted my strength over it. But I don't like vice, and I didn't want it. You have been watching me of late. Do you know that I looked upon our iconoclasts with spite, from envy of their hopes? But you had no need to be afraid. I could not have been one of them, for I never shared anything with them. And to do it for fun, from spite, I could not either. Not because I am afraid of the ridiculous. I cannot be afraid of the ridiculous. But because I have, after all, the habits of a gentleman, and it disgusted me. But if I had felt more spite and envy of them, I might perhaps have joined them. You can judge how hard it has been for me, and how I've struggled from one thing to another. Dear friend, great and tender heart which I divined, perhaps you dream of giving me so much love and lavishing on me so much that is beautiful from your beautiful soul that you hope to set up some aim for me at last by it. No, it's better for you to be more cautious. My love will be as petty as I am myself, and you will be unhappy. Your brother told me that the man who loses connection with his country loses his gods, that is, all his aims. One may argue about everything endlessly, but from me nothing has come but negation, with no greatness of soul, no force. Even negation has not come from me. Everything has always been petty and spiritless. Kirillov, in the greatness of his soul, could not compromise with an idea and shot himself. But I see, of course, that he was great-souled because he had lost his reason. I can never lose my reason, and I can never believe in an idea to such a degree as he did. I cannot even be interested in an idea to such a degree. I can never, never shoot myself. I know I ought to kill myself, to brush myself off the earth like a nasty insect, but I am afraid of suicide, for I am afraid of showing greatness of soul. I know that it will be another sham again, the last deception in an endless series of deceptions. What good is there in deceiving oneself, simply to play at greatness of soul? Indignation and shame I can never feel, therefore not despair. Forgive me for writing so much. I wrote without noticing. 100 pages would be too little, and 10 lines would be enough. 10 lines would be enough to ask you to be a nurse. Since I left Skvoreshniki, I've been living at the 6th station on the line, at the station master's. I got to know him in the time of debauchery 5 years ago in Petersburg. No one knows I am living there. Write to him. I enclose the address. Nikolai Stavrogin. Darya Pavlovna went at once and showed the letter to Varvara Petrovna. She read it and asked Dasha to go out of the room so that she might read it again alone, but she called her back very quickly. "Are you going?" she asked, almost timidly. "I am going," answered Dasha. "Get ready. We'll go together." Dasha looked at her inquiringly. "What is there left for me to do here? What difficulty will it make? I'll be naturalized in Uri too, and live in the valley. Don't be uneasy. I won't be in the way." They began packing quickly to be in time to catch the midday train, but in less than half an hour's time, Alexei Yegorych arrived from Skvoreshniki. He announced that Nikolai Vsyevolodovich had suddenly arrived that morning by the early train and was now at Skvoreshniki, but in such a state that his honour did not answer any questions, walked through all the rooms, and shut himself up in his own wing. "Though I received no orders, I thought it best to come and inform you," Alexei Yegorych concluded with a very significant expression. Varvara Petrovna looked at him searchingly and did not question him. The carriage was got ready instantly. Varvara Petrovna set off with Dasha. They say that she kept crossing herself on the journey. In Nikolai Vsyevolodovich's wing of the house, all the doors were open, and he was nowhere to be seen. "Wouldn't he be upstairs?" Fomushka ventured. It was remarkable that several servants followed Varvara Petrovna, while the others all stood waiting in the drawing room. They would never have dared to commit such a breach of etiquette before. Varvara Petrovna saw it and said nothing. They went upstairs. There were three rooms, but they found no one there. "Wouldn't his honour have gone up there?" someone suggested, pointing to the door of the loft. And in fact, the door of the loft, which was always closed, had been opened and was standing ajar. The loft was right under the roof and was reached by a long, very steep and narrow wooden ladder. There was a sort of little room up there, too. "I'm not going up there. Why should he go up there?" said Varvara Petrovna, turning terribly pale as she looked at the servants. They gazed back at her and said nothing. Dasha was trembling. Varvara Petrovna rushed up the ladder. Dasha followed, but she had hardly entered the loft when she uttered a scream and fell senseless. The citizen of the canton of Uri was hanging there behind the door. On the table lay a piece of paper with the words in pencil, "No one is to blame. I did it myself." Beside it, on the table, lay a hammer, a piece of soap, and a large nail, obviously an extra one in case of need. The strong silk cord upon which Nikolai Vsyevolodovich had hanged himself had evidently been chosen and prepared beforehand, and was thickly smeared with soap. Everything proved that there had been premeditation and consciousness up to the last moment. At the inquest, our doctors absolutely and emphatically rejected all idea of insanity. The End.